First and foremost, a big thank you first to Yossi Cooperman, who's sponsoring all of the classes tonight, the Beit Midrash generally, in loving memory of his grandmother, Rose Dashavni. Anyone know her? No? Rezel Bas Chaim. And then specifically this class is being sponsored by the Berkmans, Mark and Badana. I'm sure everyone remembers them very fondly. They're in Eretz Yisrael now, and they listen to these classes that I just mentioned. I have a lot of recordings on Y.U. Torah. So Mark and Badana are sponsoring this class specifically in memory of Mark's grandfather, Abraham Lutzky, Avram ben Moshe ben Yamin, and his uncle, Robert Lutzky, Reuben ben Avram, Mirat Hashem, through their support of the shul and their tzedakah. And our learning tonight, their neshamos will have aliyahs, their souls will have an elevation. Okay, tonight is a very special shiur, very special class. We're talking about someone named Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich. Rav Dov Ber. Why is this person so special? In my opinion, in my humble opinion, I believe Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich is responsible for all of the Hasidic sects in the world. That's a bold statement. And you would think that maybe the person responsible for all of Hasidic sects is the Baal Shem Tov. But as we'll see, the Baal Shem Tov was a very unique character, and in many ways a foundational character. But if it were up to the Baal Shem Tov, there would not be something called Hasidus today. But in order to understand that, we have to understand a little bit of the history. So first of all, this is a big book. Right? This is a big book. I got this a few years ago. A lot of history about Hasidus. You can see the thickness of it. Everybody on the stream, you can see how thick it is. Lots of pages. What is this? 1,000 pages? Almost 1,000 pages. About the history of Hasidus. And it's a wonderful newer book. It has a compilation of different historians, not just one person. But it is a lot to talk about, the history of Hasidus. So obviously we're only going to scratch even the beginning of the history tonight. But the Baal Shem Tov, and this is the most intriguing part to me in terms of what I want to research, what I want to look into, if anybody knows more information about this. The Baal Shem Tov was not the first Baal Shem, by which I don't mean he wasn't just the first person, he wasn't the first person to go by the name of Baal Shem. I mean he's not even the first person to go by the name of Baal Shem and to be a Has or someone who's, you know, promoting what we now call Hasidus. There were other smaller Hasidic sects, they weren't called Hasidim at that time. They weren't even called during the Baal Shem Tov's time. But there were more ecstatic versions of Judaism or ecstatic rituals of Judaism that were already taking place. You know, that fervency that we associate Hasidus with, that emotional side that we associate Hasidus with, that was already happening in these little small pockets. No one really knows about them. And I'm very intrigued to learn more about those. But the one who's really given the credence to starting Hasidus is the Baal Shem Tov. Now, we don't know much about the Baal Shem Tov, but suffice it to say, we're talking about the mid-18th century. We talk about Hasidus. You think in your mind, like, how many Hasidim are there? What's the proportion of Hasidim, you know, in the general, you know, Orthodox? Oh, there you go. Steve's got a book there. It looks like it's in German, so it wouldn't help me. But, or at least the author's name is in German. Michelstadt, oh, that's just his name. Okay, so it looks like an English book with a German-sounding last name author. But the point is that we're talking about perhaps the greatest recognizable form of Judaism today. Not, you know, there are different factions of Orthodox Jewry, obviously. You know, you have your yeshivish, and you have the modern Orthodox, and you have whatever. But Hasidim, generally, are most recognizable only because of their outward garb. That could be true. But you think about when Hasidus started, we're really talking only about 250 years ago. Maybe 260, 270. And there are different, and it's very hard to get these dates right, because so much of early Hasidus is non-documented, undocumented, I should say. And there's a good reason for that. And the reason for that, I think, or I can you know, I can conjecture, is closely tied to how Hasidus really took hold and how Hasidus became popular. And that is, Hasidism was a movement for the non-educated. Now, that sounds almost like a criticism, but it's not. When you think of Orthodox Judaism, when you think of what I do here in the shul, when you think of what Jewish day schools do, what do? You take out a book, you teach a kid how to read, you teach a kid how to open up a Chumash, how to open up a Gemara, right? You go through the schooling, you go through normal education, and if they know a thing or two, they know how to do what they're doing, then you go to yeshiva afterwards. And we're talking in the early 18th century, and we're talking in Europe. We're not talking in, American 21st century. We're talking about small communities. If you're not Vilna, or if you're not named, Krakow, we're talking about small communities that don't have a lot of resources. They don't have printing presses. They don't have a lot of teachers. And they certainly don't have big libraries. And that naturally leads to a lack of education, just by the sheer lack of resources. A lack of education, a lack of time, extra time to study extracurricularly. So when you think about these small Jewish neighborhoods, there's a very strong tradition, right? Very strong Mistora, as Tevye tells us over and over, right? Tradition is everything. And that's how Judaism existed. That's how Judaism thrived, by having these strongly held traditions. But it wasn't for most people that didn't live in these big cities, it was not a religion of academia. It was not a religion. If you wanted to know, like nowadays, we're blessed, and embarrassed by the luxuries that we have that we don't use. We're blessed with bookshelves full of Svarim, English Svarim that we could translate in our own language. It's unbelievable. If you wanted to learn Shulchan Aruch in the 18th century, you had to travel to Vilna. You had to travel to Krakow. You'd have to go find the people that knew how to read. Find the people that knew how. Now, I might be dramatizing this a little bit, but the point is that if you wanted to be what was considered an Oved Hashem par excellence, you'd have to go find a teacher. You'd have to go find a place with books. These were not something every village had. And then comes Hasidus. What's Hasidism all about? And this is, in some ways, the main, sticking point that we're going to talk about later with the Maggid, right, with the Rav Dov Ber, who we're talking about tonight. Hasidus is all about emotional ecstasy, emotional connection to Hashem, an experiential Judaism, not one which is focused on the academia and the scholarship as much, although obviously that's important, but ultimately it gets flack, it gets criticized for decentralizing a scholarship, for decentralizing learning. And that's precisely why, on the one hand, it takes off, because these villages with a lower socioeconomic level of people who don't know how to read as well, who don't have the books to read as well, but they can daven, and they can sing, and they can have a fabrengen, right? They can do all these Hasidic things because they don't require this lofty expertise of skill level to understand. Now, this is only one way of presenting. There are a lot of other things that might be, working in the time. There's the whole, backdrop of Shabtai Tzvi and the Tachvatat and, the Khmelnytsky rebellion, a lot of terrible things that were happening. People were looking for some kind of redemption. They were looking for some kind of salvation, and Hasidism might have brought that up, but the dates don't exactly match up. My impression is like this. It's a socioeconomic, I always follow the money, This is in the other direction. Follow the lack of money, that Hasidism takes off because people were able to connect to something, powerful. Whereas the people until now that were powerful in Judaism, the rabbis, in the yeshivas, in the big cities. But this is a way that everybody could connect. And that's a very important lesson for everybody, to find that way that you can connect and run with it. And that's what Hasidism does. On the same, the flip side of that phenomenon, right, the flip side of that same reality of a low socioeconomic status for many of these smaller communities, at least at the beginning of Hasidus, before it gets into the big cities, is that they don't have the same resources to write everything down. They don't have historians and academics that are documenting what's going on And they don't even have, a lot of these early rabbis, the Baal Shem Tov, didn't write any Svarim. And the Magid of Mezrich didn't write any Svarim. And his students didn't write any Svarim. Now there might be a tradition that they didn't want to write things down, or there is a certain intimacy to their disciples, etc. But the point is, we don't have a lot of documentation at all from the early years of Chassidus. And that's why, and that's a general overview and disclaimer to the fact that we don't really know how the Baal Shem Tov or the Magid really grew up. We have these legends, and they're brought down in a sefer called Toldos Yaakov Yosef, which was written by one of the Baal Shem Tov's main disciples, Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polonia, I never know how to pronounce any of these names, Polonia, but he writes this book, and it has a lot of these fantastical stories about the Baal Shem Tov and his disciples, and you never know what's true and what's not true. I mean, if we're going to be entirely honest, obviously a lot of, legends about the Baal Shem Tov, and I'm sure Steve's book that he was holding up before probably has a lot of those legends. This book does a pretty good job of distilling out what's probably historically accurate, what's probably not. This book, Tales of Chassidim by Martin Buber, you might be familiar with Martin Buber, a very important historian of this time, first-hand historian of a lot of these things, traveled around to different communities and most likely tells a story about the Magid of Mezrich himself. So a lot of these are legends. A lot of these are the fantastical stories that you find written about many of these early figures. But now let's jump into it with that disclaimer that we don't really know who the Magid was as a young child. Now let's explain who the Magid was as a young child. So he was born probably around the year 1710, maybe earlier, 1704. It depends where you look. And he's born in a place called Volyn in Ukraine, which was in the general Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And we don't really know much about him as a child, but there is one story. Some people say this story applies to somebody else. I don't know if people know the singer-songwriter Baruch Levin. Let me see. What songs do you know from Baruch Levin? V'zakeini legadel. You know the song? U'meirim esora. Anyways. Yes, the Polish to give me a thumbs up. They know the song. So Baruch Levin has a lot of beautiful songs. And it's unfortunate that people don't know some of his other songs. But another one, he has a V'hu Keili. V'hu Keili V'chai Goali V'tor Chavli. Anyways, beautiful, beautiful songs. I wish more people knew them because I like singing them. But Estemach David, I could try singing that. No one's going to know that one. Shema Kolenu, he has a lot of beautiful songs. Either way, he came out with a CD, which is a wonderful CD, and it's all on YouTube. You can listen to the whole CD, which is a, 10 or 11 tracks of English songs. And the CD is called Touched by a Niggun. Touched by a Niggun, Niggun is a song. And some of them are written to other songs, some of them I think are new songs. A lot of them are stories. I think maybe all of them are stories. Very interesting stuff. And he has a song there about the origins of Licha Dodi. He has a nice analogy song by Paderewski, the pianist, which is actually used in non-Jewish circles too, but it's a beautiful song. The story is used in non-Jewish circles. He made a song about the same story and used the analogy. But he has a story there. I believe it's called The Next Gadol Hador. And in the song, he does not mention who the story is about. But the story is about a boy who's trying to take care of his mother and trying to go to work and trying to make ends meet for the family. And ultimately, their house catches on fire. And the house is on fire and the whole thing burns down. And while he and his mother are watching the fire from, the hillside, they're watching their house burn down, the mother is crying. And this little boy, who's maybe 5 or 8 years old, goes to his mother and says, "Don't worry, Mom. I'll work extra hard, and I'll take on an extra shift, and whatever. We'll make the money back, and we'll build a new house." And she said, "That's not what I'm crying about. I'm crying about the Sefer Hayichus. Sefer Hayichus is a book of genealogy. Like when you say the word Yichus, people know the word Yichus from Shadchanus, right? From Shidduch, right? Yichus. You need to have Yichus, right?" So she said, we had this book up there that told you, that told about all the illustrious rabbis that came in our family that we're descended from. And that was in the house, and that burned down. So the little boy goes back to his mother and says, don't worry, Mom, I'm going to make you a new book of Yichus, and I'm going to be your first gadol. I'm going to be the first rabbi in that book. So that's the story, and it's a beautiful story. So I encourage you, I guess, to find the story on YouTube. You can listen to it. That's the intro of the song. Anyways, very nice song. They say that that story is about Rav Dov Ber Mezrich. This guy that we're talking about, 5 or 8 years old, orphaned, house burned down, tells his mother, I'm going to be a gadol. That's what he says. Now, I've heard the story about other rabbis, but it is written in this book by Martin Buber about the Magen of Mezrich. So it's documented that it's about, at least some say it's about him. Either way, he gets a traditional cheder upbringing, cheder being, you know, the Aleph Beis and the Chumash, and he gets a typical upbringing of general basic knowledge of Torah. Ultimately, however, he was unsatisfied. That wasn't enough for him. And unclear when this happens. We don't have the dates of any of these things. But they say that instead he turned to Kabbalah. He was intrigued by the writings of the Ramchal. The Ramchal was Rav Moshe Chaim Lusato. I don't know if we've talked about him or not. I think we have. He died at a young age, 40 years old, but he wrote many, many books. And part of the reason he died, I think we talked about him. I've definitely talked about him before. I don't remember if it was here or not. That he died at an early age because he contracted a disease along with his family when he moved to Israel. And he had to move to Israel because he kept getting thrown out of all these other European cities. Why did he keep getting thrown out of the European cities? Because he wanted to teach Kabbalah. And ever since Shabtai Tzvi, you know, divided the Jewish people, right, and he caused all this commotion, he caused all this anguish amongst the Jewish people through the use of Kabbalah, the rabbi said, no more Kabbalah. You can't learn it, you can't teach it, you can't abuse it, you can't manipulate it, it's going to create more division, no more Kabbalah. And the Ramchal connected to Kabbalah, he wanted to teach it. Now, he was younger than 40 years old, but nonetheless, the rabbis did, he wanted to learn it, and the rabbis didn't let him. And he goes from town to town, and this is obviously a generalized idea, and he really does filter out a lot of Kabbalah. We know the Ramchal from his books like Derech Hashem, and from Mesilas Yesharim, right? The Path of the Just. You might be familiar with that book, Mesilas Yesharim. It's the sort of the building blocks of Musar Svarim in Judaism come from the Ramchal. You look at that, you don't see any Kabbalah. It's not explicit, at least. But nonetheless, he had these other books that people didn't like. So ultimately, the Magid of Mezrich, no, not yet the Magid of Mezrich, Rav Dov Ber, connects to the Ramchal's writings, his Kabbalistic writings that we don't really know about. And we being me and you, not other people, I'm sure other people read it, but he connects the Kabbalah, he wants to learn more. He ultimately comes to the Arizal's understanding of Kabbalah, which is probably also the Ramchal's understanding. I don't know enough about it, but the Arizal, when he came onto the scene in the 17th century, essentially laid the groundwork for everybody for how to understand Kabbalah through the Zohar, different ways you can understand it. He wrote his own books, fine. We've talked about the Arizal before. I feel like we have. He lives very aesthetic lifestyle on his own island, whatever. Eventually, he was, in his own way, maybe because of the Kabbalah, maybe just generally because of his personality, he also led an aesthetic lifestyle. He fasted a lot. He lived as a poor person. He davened a lot. And eventually, he actually developed major health concerns, especially with his legs. This made a problem for him. Generally, he couldn't get around easily, which is interesting that ultimately he's called the Magid. The Magid, historically, moniker. A moniker, the Magid, it's like a name, a nickname, a title you would give to someone who goes around to different cities and gives and teaches. The Magid of Mezrich didn't really get around very easily. Maybe he did go around, but he did not get around as much as other Magidim did. You think about like the Dubna Magid, right? So the Dubna Magid went around to different towns and he would give Musar Shmuz, he would give drashas, whatever. The Magid of Mezrich was not very healthy. And part of the reason that he ultimately finds the Baal Shem Tov, right, Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, who was only maybe 10 years his senior, the reason he goes there is because he kept going to all these physical doctors, trying to heal his legs, and none of them did anything for him, so he figured, why don't I go to a spiritual healer? So he goes to the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem, the word Baal Shem, the moniker Baal Shem, was reserved for people who did spiritual healing / herbal healing, right? The Baal Shem sort of roped people in with his herbal medicines, and then he taught him about the spiritual aspects of things also. So the Baal Shem Tov comes, or the Magid comes to the Baal Shem Tov. And he's either trying to learn more about the Baal Shem Tov, or he's trying to heal his own illnesses. And ultimately, the Baal Shem Tov was very unimpressive. That sounds counterintuitive, right? We're expecting some big, we're expecting him to hit it off. But no, originally, the Magid comes to the Baal Shem, and he's just teaching regular Torah. You know, good old Chumash, good old Gemara, and he's very unimpressed. And the Magid is about to leave. Ultimately, someone sends for the Magid as he's packing up his bags and says, the Baal Shem Tov wants to talk to you. He goes into the Baal Shem Tov, and ultimately, the Baal Shem Tov gives him a whole new interpretation or an insight into a sefer called Eitz Chaim, from the Arizal, I believe. And through this insight, through this some kind of experience, the Baal Shem Tov brought this light into the room, and he brought the angel. This is all the legend that they say. And the Magid was like taken aback, and he decided, this is where I'm supposed to be, and he stayed. The question, however, is, how long does the Magid actually stay with the Baal Shem Tov? It's not very clear. Some say that he was only there for 2 years. 2 years, the Magid of Mezrich was with the Baal Shem. Why is that interesting? Because the Baal Shem Tov had a bit of an inner circle. He had some other rabbis around him who could have been given the mantle of leadership that were there for much longer. I mentioned before Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polon, who wrote the Toldos Yaakov Yosef about the Baal Shem Tov's upbringing and his life, whatever. It is very unclear why the Baal Shem Tov didn't give it to Rav Yaakov Yosef. Why didn't he say that Yaakov Yosef was going to be the next Rebbe of Hasidus? Not very clear. Second place behind, my intrigue for the other smaller sects of Hasidus before Hasidus started. I want to know about the relationship of Rav Yaakov Yosef and the Magid of Mezrich. It's a bit of a mystery. A lot of historians, suggest that there was a lot of tension there because the Magid was given the mantle of leadership to take over from the Baal Shem Tov. Rav Yaakov Yosef was there, was his main student. So it's not very clear why, but one of the main indications that they had friction, that they had tension between the two of them, is because if you look through the Toldos Yaakov Yosef, which I have not done, Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polon quotes a lot of the other colleagues of the Baal Shem Tov, right? All the colleagues of him, students of the Baal Shem Tov. But he never, ever quotes the Magid of Mezrich, which is a red flag. Something a little off about that. Why wouldn't Rav Yaakov Yosef quote the next most formidable Talmud of the Baal Shem? Not clear. Either way, the Baal Shem Tov dies 2 years after meeting the Magid, Rav Dov Ber, and ultimately he chooses his son. The Baal Shem Tov chooses his son, Rav Tzvi. But Rav Tzvi couldn't do it, and he gave up less than a year later. The competition was between the Magid and Rav Yaakov Yosef, as I said before. It seems as if the unanimous decision was to choose the Magid. Why? I don't know. Everybody liked the Magid more for some reason or another. And he ultimately made his own way of teaching the ideas of Chassidus. If you look at this book, right, this book goes through the beginnings of this movement. And really, the reason I call the beginnings of the movement is because the Baal Shem Tov was from where? Anyone know where Baal Shem Tov is from? It's the name of the city, not that you would know what it is. It's called Mezhebezh. Mezhebezh, with a bunch of Z's and H's. Mezhebezh is also in Ukraine, not too far from Mezrich, but not the same place either. And he never left there. The Baal Shem Tov stayed in Mezhebezh. And all of his students stayed in Mezhebezh. That Baal Shem Tov inner circle was all centered in Mezhebezh. Comes the Maggid of Mezrich, and you think, I don't know what you're saying. Yes, we'll get there, Michael. You think Chabad started Shlichus? You haven't met the Maggid yet. The Maggid of Mezrich took it upon himself to decide, he decided we have to spread the ideas of Chassidus. And this is why I believe the Maggid is responsible for Hasidism today. Because if it was up to Baal Shem, they've had this little click in the middle of Mezhebezh, and they would stay like that. But the Maggid says we have to spread these ideas. Now, the Maggid also distilled some of the ideas of the Arizal and the ideas of the Baal Shem into his own digestible, ideas for the masses, for other people to understand them. So, for instance, the concept of a symptom and klipos, people understand these things. But the point is that the Maggid turns the concept of Kabbalah into something people could understand a little bit more. Let me just find here a paragraph that would best explain things to you. Yeah, both the Maggid and his disciples understood that this radical teaching might easily be mistaken for pantheism. You know what pantheism is? Pantheism is that the world is God and God is the world. Right? He's infused into the world. That sounds a lot like Hasidus, right? That God's presence was embedded into the physical world, and it's our job to release the light, the spiritual light that's in everything. Those are the nisotos, the sparks. And the shivri kalim, things broken down, you have to put them back together, right? When you eat an apple and you say bracha on the apple, you bring the light out of the apple, right? But it sounds a lot like God is the world and the world is God. That's not what it means. God is much bigger than the world, but there are aspects, spiritual aspects of holiness that are embedded in the world. But the thrust both of the teachings and of the experience that clearly behind them was difficult to hide, such phrases as, the whole earth is filled up with his glory, right? Melo chol ha'aretz kivado. I say that phrase a few times, and there is no place devoid of him. Teachings attributed to Vesh were central to the Maggid's theology, as well as they conjured up seemingly heretical idea that God and his world were one and the same. Hold on. Oh, and this is the main part. This is the main part. I've thought about this in terms of the way I give over ideas also. Although the Maggid's mysticism appears highly theoretical, and this is so fundamental to Hasidus, this is what makes Hasidus different from Kabbalah. Although the Maggid's mysticism appears highly theoretical, Hasidism is primarily devotional. The question asked over and over again in the sources is not what is the nature of God, but rather how do I properly serve him? Right? The point is not to understand the world. The point is not to understand God. We can't possibly do that. No matter how mystical we get, and no matter how theoretical we try to understand the Zohar, that's not our purpose. The purpose is, what do I do to connect to God? And that's Hasidism. Because Hasidism is all about, in a nutshell, that's pun intended, a nutshell, you're bringing God into this world. Right? That's the point. The point is to create an intimacy with God through the physical world. That you can fit a lot of ideas into that general phrase. Whereas Kabbalah, the learning of Kabbalah, is in many ways a commentary of God in the ether, not in this world, right? It might explain God in ways this way or that way. The concept of Tzimtzum was changed, or it was clarified. Didn't they change? It was clarified. Tzimtzum, according to earlier versions of interpreting the Zohar, meant that God retracted from the world. He took a step back from the world, right? Tzimtzum meaning he made himself, smaller or gone from it. But in Hasidism, it meant that God made himself small to be put into the world. It's very different dynamic there. So the point here is, how do I relate to God? Unlike the medieval Kabbalists who depicted esoteric lore as the way of truth, Hasidic authors speak of the way of service or devotion. The Maggid's metaphysical insights need to be seen in this context. His teaching seems to have grown out of his own experience. Both types of dvekos discussed in previous chapters, communion with God or unification with him. The teachings were intended to lead the Maggid's audience toward a similar inner state of mind. This inward attachment to God replaces the prior Kabbalistic hierarchy of tikkun or cosmic repair. We're not fixing the world outside of ourselves. We're doing what we can do to connect. Focusing now on the present moment rather than on the future uplifting of the Shekhinah and restoring the cosmic order. It demands an experiential mysticism rather than an esoteric knowledge. That's Hasidism. Experiential. True worship is undertaken for the sake of God rather than one's own needs. The pleasure one may take in joyous acts of prayer, study, and commandments are a reflection of the great joy these acts bring about above. A beautiful sort of encapsulation of what the Maggid was trying to give over in Hasidus. Not about understanding the world, but understanding my place in it. Understanding my relationship with Hashem. These ideas were somewhat only distilled through the Maggid. The Baal Shem might have been talking more in Kabbalistic terms. The Maggid spoke more in experiential terms. Okay. And then, as I said before, he sends out the troops. One of his youngest disciples you might be familiar with is, anyone know any of the Maggid students? I mean, you know the Maggid students, you might just not remember them. A man named Rav Shner Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitch Rebbe. Well, I don't know what to say. He's not a Lubavitch. He goes to Liadi. So he's not the first Lubavitch Rebbe, he's the first Rebbe of Chabad, of the movement which ultimately is called Chabad, whatever. He was a teenager at the time. People might know the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which is the Baal HaTanya of Shner Zalman's corpus of Halacha, right? The Shulchan Aruch. And that Shulchan Aruch is actually very formidable in the Mishnah Berurah's understanding of how to do things, which is fascinating, just historically, development of Halacha. But he was given that task by the Maggid. The Maggid told him, we need a halakhic text which can serve as the source for us Hasidim. And that's what Shner Zalman does. So you have also other well-known, well-established Hasidic students of the Maggid. Rav Shmulka Horowitz goes to a place called Nicholsburg. Nicholsburg had a bit of an interruption in the leadership around World War II, but I believe it's picked up again in Nicholsburg of Hasidus. I believe that's true. Nicholsburg, I believe maybe they're in Boston. I don't remember exactly. But there is still now today a Nicholsburg of Hasidus, which comes all the way back to Rav Shmelka of Nicholsburg, which was from the Maggid. The Maggid sent Rav Shmelka to Nicholsburg. He had a brother of Pinchas Halevi Horowitz, who himself was not so Hasidish, but was connected to the Maggid of Mezrich. He wrote a formidable commentary on Halacha called the Hafla, the Sefer Hafla. But the point is, these were everybody you have, the early stage of Hasidus, that early stage, they were all mainstream Talmudic scholars, because there was no such thing as Hasidus. Right? So anyone who the Maggid picks up as a student was originally, you know, on the mainstream cheder yeshiva path, because there was nowhere else to come from. Right? It's not like they came from another Hasidic Rebbe over to them. They came from the regular cheder. So a lot of these characters sort of, you know, play both sides of the fence. The Hasidic and the Talmudic, if you could say it that way. Rav Aaron Perlow of Karlin. Anyone know who that is? Rav Aaron HaGadol. The Karliner Hasidim. People know Bnei Israel over here. Right? Rabbi Blech is a Karliner Hasid. Right, and he has a shir on Rav Aaron's Torah. I don't know if it's him or his grandson. His grandson is also Rav Aaron. I don't know which one he gives over on Shabbos morning, but he gives a shir in Rav Aaron's ideas. They say that the Karliners, the first Karliners, I think they... Who's the one that has a yard site here that they come in for? Is that Karlin? I don't think it is. It's somebody else. Either way, So that was when the Vilna Gaon, which we'll talk about in a second, opposed Chassidus. He was thinking about the Karlinas. People were telling him about the Karlinas were doing. They were very, you know, ecstatic in their davening. They did like these crazy exercises and jumps and cartwheels and things like to daven. Rabbi Yisrael of Kuznets, the Kuznets are Maggid. Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk might be the namesake of many Menachem Mendels. I think his children get married into the Rav Shneur Zalman's children, which creates the Menachem Mendel chain that still continues to today, right? Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And Rav Levi Yitzchak of Arditchas, the Kedushas Levi. These are some hard-hitting, you know, formidable figures in the Hasidic movement. They were all students of the Maggid. They were all sent away by the Maggid. And they all have their different thing. Perhaps one of the main students of the Maggid was Rav Noam Elimelech of Lezhansk. Rav Noam Elimelech, whose kever you can, a lot of these people still have their kfarim you can visit. Some of them are in main places, some of them are in, you know, these little towns, as we've been saying. These little towns were why Hasidism sort of took over. But Rav Noam Elimelech has a kever, it's a joint kever with somebody else, I can't remember who it was. But people know, I don't know if people know, Avram Fried's song, Adar Abba. It was originally written by Yossi Green. So anyway, that's Rav Noam Elimelech. That's not even his name. His name was Elimelech, but the sefer was called Noam Elimelech. Anyways, so Rav Elimelech of Lezhansk, but the sefer is called Noam Elimelech. But Noam is not his name. Some people have the name Noam, right? That's the name of. Anyways, Rav Nachum of Chernobyl. Anyone know Rav Nachum of Chernobyl's last name? Twersky, right? That's the Twersky. A student of the Maggid of Mezrich. All of these formidable characters come from the Maggid, right? How many people know of the students of the Baal Shem Tov? Not many. They don't create many Hasidic sects. The Hasidic sects come from the Maggid of Mezrich. He sends all of these people out to their own places. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi only got to Liadi because the Maggid told him to go there. Right? Rav Aaron HaGadol of Karlin only got to Karlin because he told him to go there. Rav Yisrael of Kuznets, Rav Nachman of Chernobyl, right? All these people become their own rebbes in their own courts, as they say, because of the Maggid. An unbelievable character, an unbelievable vision, which creates the Hasidic lore. And because of this, Hasidus spread. There's another possible reason why the Hasidism spreads. I've spoken about, usually in this time slot, we do Mishle, so I've spoken about here in this time slot, the author Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell has a book called The Tipping Point, and he also has another book called Originals. In The Tipping Point, he talks about how certain ideas become viral, or some certain ideas become sort of worldwide revolutions and things like that. And he also has his book called Originals, where he talks about experts become leading figures in their field, not only because of their expertise, but because of a lot of luck. A lot of things that are happening at the same time. So this is one of those things. What's the tipping point of Hasidus? What allows it to flourish despite the backlash that they get from other mainstream cities? The Vad Arba Aratzos. Anyone know what the Vad Arba Aratzos was? The Council of the Four Lands. I don't know if we've talked about it or not. But this was, in many ways, a self-governing body in the major European cities for the Jewish community, that basically took care of all the taxes for the secular government and also gave us a certain self-autonomy, which was in many ways unprecedented, to have a rabbinic autonomous body that could really dictate to at least the Ashkenazic world how to properly do this or that situation, deal with this or that situation. But there was ultimately in the 17th and 18th century, there was a lot of abuse, a lot of manipulation, and a lot of corruption that came into the Vada Avarasos. Ultimately, it was dissolved because of some of these things. It coincided with The Rav Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonatan Eibshitz controversy, which we don't have to go into now. It has a little bit to do with Shabtai Tzvi, but it might have more to do with certain rabbinic positions that were taken in Amsterdam, but not for now. Ultimately, the decentralization of Polish rabbis without the Vad Arba Ratzos left a void. It left a void of leadership, and it left a void of education. Hasidism seamlessly comes onto the scene in the late 18th century, right? The Vad Arba Ratzos was closed in 1764. The rabbis were not very happy with Hasidus when it came on the scene, but there was no Vad anymore. There was no centralized governing body that dictated what was and what wasn't appropriate for Jewish communities, and therefore Hasidus remained. Now, if one were to pick at the end, towards the end, you know, at this time, who would be the most formidable Gadol Hador for the Jewish people in the late 1700s, who would it be? Well, the Magidus and Hasidic communities. Who in the mainstream community would be seen as sort of the Gadol Hador? Probably the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, the Eliel Kramer. And this is perhaps there are a lot of descriptions you could give to this scene, but one of the main defining moments in Hasidic history is when the Vilna Gaon speaks out against Hasidism. Now, I say most defining not because they had to go up against the sort of the Vilna Gaon, but because it brought a lot more attention to Hasidus. Right? You can imagine if there's this no-name figure out in the ether, nobody's even talking about them, and the Gadol Hador starts talking about them against them, opposing them, everyone's going to be, wait, who's that? Tell me about that person that you're speaking out against. That's what happens in many ways in Hasidus. The Vilna Gaon, who was himself a very quiet person, he was in many ways what we would call a hermit, a recluse. He would sit in his room and he would learn. He had his, you know, his davening and his yeshiva, but he was not a public figure. He did not get involved with public debates and public issues. But for this, he came out and he made a public declaration. I think he even made two of them in 1771. And he talks about how nobody should ever associate with this new sect called Hasidim. Now, it wasn't even called Hasidim then. I think some people say that he called them Karliners. I'd have to look back at the text. But we have it. We have the actual, because when the Vilna Gaon says something, everybody hears about it. They make copies. They rewrite it. They send it out to all the communities. And this, as you can imagine, only fueled. Now, where's the Vilna Gaon? He's in Vilna. So he's preaching to the choir in Vilna. There is no Hasidus in Vilna. That's where the yeshivas are. That's where all the books are. You don't need Hasidus in Vilna. So who's he talking to? Right? Is he talking to the villages that are never going to get this? Right? So it was a very hard sell. It was a very hard argument to make when he's sitting in the headquarters of the Jewish mainstream Talmudic scholars, trying to convince everybody else in other places that they shouldn't follow Hasidus. Now, there's a lot to be said for what the Vilna Gaon knew or didn't know about Hasidism. If it's true that he only knew about Karlin, so he might have had good reason to be oppositional about it. Even today's Karlin doesn't do what Karlin did back then. As I said before, they did cartwheels, they did jumping jacks, they were running around. They were really experiencing their davening. It was not something like shuckling hard, right? I mean, now you can find that in Karlin nowadays, maybe some clapping and stuff, but there's nothing like this. And the Vilna Gaon spoke out against it. This is not appropriate, etc. But in the end of the day, what was interpreted was that the Vilna Gaon doesn't like Hasidus. Now, the students, grand students and great-grand students of the Vilna Gaon take a very different tone. One can assume, I would assume, and this is how I understand it. I don't remember if I saw it from a historian or not, but I would assume that the Vilna Gaon was coming from a perspective of what he saw in the rearview mirror, which was Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, the Sabbatean movement of false messiah, trying to change, he changed Judaism, he really did. He used Kabbalah, he used mysticism, and he changed halachas. So the Vilna Gaon is trying to nip this movement in the bud. And he's looking at this new movement, also using Kabbalah, they're jumping around, they're doing different things, and he's saying, whoa, we can't do this again. That's the charitable read of what the Vilna Gaon did. He came out in such staunch opposition. Would the Vilna Gaon be as opposed to Chassidus today, knowing how it developed in 250 years? I would like to think not. They keep halacha. They might have some, you know, peculiar minhagim from a sort of a Talmudic point of view. But nonetheless, they haven't gone off the deep end in terms of messianism and thinking Mashiach is already here and stuff like that. So unclear exactly what the Vilna Gaon would think. But the point is, historically, the Vilna Gaon was seen as the main opposition, as the leader of what's called the Mitznagdim, the Mitznagdim, the opposers of Chassidus. Story goes that Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi and either Rav Menach Mendel of Vitebsk or Rav Shmekel of Nicholsburg, unclear exactly who went with him, go to Vilna and they try to have a sit down conversation with the Vilna Gaon. Now the Vilna Gaon doesn't talk to anybody except for maybe Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and he was not about to talk to some Hasidim. Right? So in the end, the Vilna Gaon does not allow a meeting to happen. And the story is, according to Chabad, and I have actually confirmed this with some other Chabadniks before, the story is, the legend is, that if Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi and Rav Shmekel of Nicholsburg would have had that meeting with the Vilna Gaon, you know what would have happened? Mashiach. Immediate, instantaneous Mashiach. Obviously, you can't prove a negative. You can't prove something that didn't actually happen. But that's what they say. That's the legend. Legend has it. If they would have only had that meeting in 1772, everything would have been done. Okay? Never actually happened. They went to Vilna, and they were turned away. They went back to Liadi, or wherever. I don't know where. Back to Liadi and Nicholsburg. Okay. But what's interesting is, and maybe this was part of the Chachma of Chassidus, maybe it was just part of their positioning, they never responded. They were never oppositional to the Mitznagdim, which is why it's called Chassidim and Mitznagdim. It's the Chassidim and the people against Chassidim. It's not the people against Chassidim and the people against the Litva. Right? It's not like that. Chassidim were like, you can have your Masorah. You can have your learning. You can have your expertise. We in the villages, and I would say, I would add, us of a different socioeconomic status, we're going to do Judaism like this. Not against halakha, just experientially different, a little bit different. And they never had a counter ban. They never said, don't go to the Vilna Gaon. They never said, to discredit the Chassam Sofer. They never said any of that. The Nodiv Yehuda has an interesting tshuva where it sounds like he's very oppositional to Chassidus also. They never banned the Nodiv Yehuda, right? So a lot of these things are sort of a one-way opposition. So that could be to the credit of Chassidus enduring. If they would have gone back and forth at each other, so who knows? In the end of the day, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi was put in prison, right? He was reported to the authorities, and they have a whole yontif when he was taken out. Was it St. Petersburg or something? He came out of the prison for the last time, as if that was the stamp of approval. That was Rav Shneur Zalman, the Baal HaTanya. The Litvaks, the opposition, yeah, the Mitznagdim. Now, you have to really kind of see a map for this, but a lot of Hasidism that's centered around Mezrich and Mezhebezh in the Poland-Ukraine border, so that's centered in this spot. Liadi was all the way up northeast in Russia. Yeah. So anything that, all the opposition with the Vilna Gaon and everything happening over here, the status quo that they created, where after 1772, it's kind of like, okay, you know, bygones be bygones, that never got up here, right? So Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who, as we said, was a young man when he was sent out there in the 1760s, he deals with this, I think he gets out of prison in the early 1800s, maybe 1798. It's like 20, 25 years after this whole scene. So it's kind of interesting how that plays out, that they didn't really come to their status quo where bygones be bygones, you know, agree to disagree. They didn't get there for another 25 years, if I remember correctly. Either way, So the Maggid of Mezrich ultimately dies in the year 1772, right after this controversy, or maybe during this controversy, when the Vilna Gaon puts out this opposition to him and to the movement. But at that time, all the Hasidim, all the Rebbes were already in their places. They were already in their stations, and it had already taken root in all these other areas. He writes a couple svarim, or at least his students write svarim, recording his drashos, because as I said before, he didn't write anything. Magid Devarav Yaakov and Likut Yikarim. There's, I think, also a Likut Amarim. But either way, the concept of Chassidus was really fueled by the Magid of Mezrich. It's not exactly clear how much was from the Baal Shem and how much was his own ideas, but the point is that if it wasn't for the Magid, there would be no Chassidus, in my opinion. He was the one that took it upon himself to spread the ideas of Chassidism, and that's why we have it all over today. All right, will we give our Shirim Pshischa? That's 2 generations later, right? This is the Magid in 1772 on Yud Tes Kislev, which is a couple of weeks from now. But that's 1772. I mean, Pshischa doesn't come up until the mid-1800s. So that's a few generations later that I personally benefit from, I personally enjoy. And there's a lot of other Hasidus that all comes because of the Magid's doing. If you go to Lubavitch's farms, everybody knows Lubavitch is very insular in terms of associating with other Hasidic sects as opposed to other Hasidic sects. It's like, okay, Stalin and Carlin and Bells and Ger, they'll all marry each other. Lubavitch marries Lubavitch, right? But Lubavitch, and therefore the story that the Torahs that they learn from their rabbis, the seven Chabad rabbis. If you go to a Sfarim store for Chabad, however, you'll see the 7 rabbis Sfarim, and then you'll see the Magid of Mezrich. You'll see the Magid Sfarim being sold at a Chabad store because they trace their lineage to the Magid also. And every Chassidus does that. Every Chassidus traces their lineage back to the Magid. So even if you won't quote, laterally to other Chassidic sects and other Chassidic rabbis, everyone traces their lineage back to the Magid. There's nobody who traces back to the, I'm sure there might be some, but there are very few, if any, that trace their lineage back to the Baal Shem and not to the Magid also. Everyone goes through the Magid. He is the one that really starts it and makes it a movement. So that's the Magid in a nutshell. There's also another concept. We talked about Nitzotos, we talked about Olam Haza and Klipos, and there's another concept of Tzadikim, right? Tzadikim, which is sort of the leader, the Rebbe is the main person of the movement, which is why you find the Fabrengans, all the Rebbe giving the Shirayim to everybody. That concept doesn't really get off the ground until later. One of his students, Rebbe Elimelech of Lezhansk, in his Noam Elimelech, talks about that a lot. And that gets filtered into the Chozeh of Lublin. That's part of the reason why Pshischa breaks off, because they don't like that concept, that there's a Rebbe and everybody else just follows the Rebbe. That's not for Pshischa, and that's not how we do it, right? So, but that concept is mentioned, it's alluded to by the Magid, that there's a pillar in the middle, and everybody else sort of goes towards the Tzaddik. He's their conduit to Hashem, so that borders on heretical. But that's another idea that's attributed to the Magid, but it's only really proliferated in the next 2 generations from Rebbe Elimelech and the Chozeh of Lublin. But ultimately, the legacy of the Magid is seen positively by many, despite his health concerns, and despite the fact that he was only with the Baal Shem for maybe 2 years, nonetheless, he got a lot done in those 2 years to attract the Baal Shem's attention, and thereby the mantle of leadership. And seems like the students made the right decision by giving it over to the Magid. Unclear what would have happened if they gave it to Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polom. Not saying it wouldn't have been good either, but the Magid had a vision. He put forth a vision, and it clearly worked to the extent where today, hundreds of thousands, if I had to guess, Hasidim all over the world from Yidden, maybe not in the same way that everybody else is, but they have their Menhagim, they have their Halacha, and they're from Jews. Baruch Hashem for the Magid and for everything he's done for Hasidism and also Jewry the world over. So that's the Magid. Thank you again for the sponsorship from the Berkmans, loving memory of his grandfather Avraham ben Moshe ben Yamin and his uncle Reuven ben Avraham. May their neshamos have aliyot. Everyone should have a good night. Thank you all for joining.